coming to Salesforce.org provided me with the opportunity to apply my technical skills to benefit tens of thousands of nonprofits. And, you know, at the time we were just doing nonprofit, not education. Now it's education as well. And that was 6.5 years ago.
That is Jason Lantz, Senior Director of Release Management for the nonprofit arm of Salesforce, Salesforce.org. I'm Josh Burke, a developer evangelist for Salesforce, and here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you will hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down with Jason to talk about managing and releasing open source projects for the nonprofit community. And we start with the big one, the Nonprofit Success Pack, or NPSP, and how it transitioned from a repo of metadata to a managed package.
Yeah, so I wasn't here during that transition, but you know, I think I've got a pretty good understanding of that at this point. And you know, I guess one thing that I'll point out, because I think this kind of shocks most people, because I think most people in the Salesforce world, when you talk about unmanaged pack or when you talk about open source, they're like, "Oh, you're talking about an unmanaged package."
Right.
And our experience has actually been, to some degree, unmanaged packages are almost the worst way to distribute open source. And the reason for that is because Salesforce makes it really easy to do customizations inside of your own org. Mm-hmm. And that's what, I mean, that's a huge part of the Salesforce ecosystem, is really good at doing that. But if you're building an open source project, part of the reason you're making it open source is so you can get contributions back. Mm-hmm. You know, especially kind of many years ago, it was not very easy to get that stuff out of your Salesforce org and contribute it back. So what happened was this complete fragmentation, where everybody started from the nonprofit template, but then customized it heavily in their own instance, and mm-hmm. and the contributions back to that core were much less. Once it's a managed package, and it's run through an open source GitHub repository that's public, now if you want to change the managed package code for some reason, you go contribute back to the GitHub repository, and then that comes out in the next release. Now, that does require you, as the publisher of a managed package, to really think through what you're putting in the package and what assumptions and decisions that's baking into the package for your users.
Right.
So you have to start thinking about your package more as a platform that people are going to want to do different things. You don't bake in implementation decisions. You build a framework for those implementation decisions to be able to be made. So it requires thinking about it in a different way, but you know, that's how we've been able to scale NPSP. So when we started our product delivery team, like about 6.5 years ago, our main goal was to get NPSP onto a release train philosophy where we're cutting new releases every 2 weeks and push upgrading them out to all users.
Oh, wow.
We started doing that about 5 years ago and have been doing it since. So wow. we're push upgrading to, you know, 40,000 plus sandbox orgs, and then 6 days later, 40,000 plus production orgs.
Wow.
And that's actually across our entire product line. And, you know, the nice thing about that is, yes, it's a little bit scary. You're getting updates every 2 weeks, right?
Right.
But on the flip side of that, every update you're getting is smaller. And
right.
So if something goes wrong, it's a lot easier to debug. The changes that were made are much fresher in our developer's mind. So if something does come up, mm-hmm. You know, we're able to kind of quickly turn around and get a new release out. And we've had actually a really amazing track record over the years of not pushing errors in production releases using this whole approach.
Nice.
I guess the key thing to point out is the only way that that's been possible is through an investment in automation, which was there from the very beginning. So I think that's really essential to being able to do it.
Right, because early on, there were some efforts to open source tools for automation and building on the platform as well. What were those kind of efforts like?
Yeah, so originally when I started, my role has been, I think my original role was lead release operations engineer, which is a really confusing title. But essentially the whole time, Kevin Bromer, who hired me here, recognized that if we were going to scale this team in the way that he had the vision to scale it, we had to invest in that kind of automation to be able to run automated builds, do continuous integration, use feature branches for development in the repository and all of that sort of stuff. So early on, you know, at the time that I was hired, everything was based on the force.com Ant migration tool, was all the kind of documentation out there, and running Jenkins. So that's the way that I started.
Yeah.
I started writing a whole bunch of stuff in Ant, took this rather silly line in the sand of, I should not write Java code. I should only write all the logic in Ant in XML. horrible choice. But, you know, we ran with that for about 2 years. And, but we managed to accomplish a pretty amazing process that's really, I mean, the process that we architected out in the first 6 months is largely the same process that we're using today. We've evolved the tooling quite a bit. But, you know, because this was built for an open source project, it was all out in a public GitHub repository. And the code name of NPSP version 3, this attempt to build out a development team, get onto a 2 week release cadence and agile development practices and stuff like that, the code name of that project internally was Cumulus. And in fact, up until just a few months ago, the GitHub repository was still called Cumulus. Mm-hmm. The fun joke internally is Cumulus is the cloud that makes it rain. As a fundraising system, that was my understanding of the reason why that was picked. So
gotcha.
The tooling that we had, all of our build scripts to create continuous integration, sort of naturally became called Cumulus CI. Mm-hmm. And initially it was ANT-based scripts. And, you know, I had other ISVs that heard about what we were doing and would reach out and, you know, hey, can I, you know, use your scripts? And, you know, I was like, sure, they're in our GitHub repository.
Right.
Go copy the build.xml, copy this lib directory, copy, you know, these other things. There was a version.properties file that you put some configuration in, and you're off and running. And they did. And then they would come back to me like, you know, 3 months later or 6 months later and experiencing some issue in the build. And it was an issue that we had already fixed in our build scripts. But again, we ran into this problem. Just like with the nonprofit template, when everybody kind of forks their own implementation and customizes it, mm-hmm. where we had fixed that problem in our build scripts, but they started from a copy six months ago of our build scripts that didn't have that fix.
Gotcha.
So that sort of led to, we tried in ANT to build a kind of standard packaged approach that people could extend, mm-hmm. And then they could update the standard packaged approach. But really, the current incarnation of Cumulus CI started about 3.5 or 4 years ago, which was converting all of that ANT code into Python, which definitely made me very happy. It was so much easier to work with. And the fun inspiration for that was we had some logic that would crawl through metadata files and generate a package XML file.
Gotcha.
And that logic, because I had drawn this line in the sand of like, we're only going to do it in ANT, had to be this kind of nasty combination of XSLT 1.0 to parse through all the files and generate some files on the file system. So it took, just for NPSP, it took about 20 seconds to generate a package XML by crawling through the metadata.
Right.
And in our builds, it was around the time that Aura came out. We started adding a bunch of extra files in, and we started hitting Java heap errors. And I didn't know how to get around those. I tried all sorts of tweaking of it, but like that was a little bit out of my realm. And I just hired the first member onto my team, and he had actually come out and was staying with me for the first week. And we were like, you know what, let's see if we can rewrite this in Python. And it took a day to rewrite that logic in Python, and in a very configurable way that's still kind of in Cumulus CI now.
Yeah.
And that XML generation logic was probably half of the heavy lifting of what our ANT scripts did.
Gotcha.
So it was like at that point, well, okay, cool. Let's just charge forward and rewrite all of this stuff in Python. And we had all the logic from our ANT scripts largely recreated in Python in about a month.
Oh, wow.
So we started down that path. And then kind of the next evolution in that was, well, where do we run this stuff? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we started with Jenkins. We had switched over to Atlassian Bamboo Cloud. And because I really didn't want to be a sysadmin, I wanted, you know, a cloud system where this stuff runs, because I wanted to write build scripts, not run a system.
Right.
And then, you know, we had been running in Bamboo Cloud. And right around that time, Atlassian announced the end of life of Bamboo Cloud right after we had transitioned to it.
Of course.
And there was the offer that, you know, we'll give you server licenses to run it on your own system. But I was like, I don't want to be a sysadmin. So what do I do? And I went to, you know, one of the other things in addition to just the awesome environment of .org that has kept me here at my job was my boss for many years, Kevin Bromer, was very open to crazy ideas that were well thought out.
Nice.
And I have a lot of crazy ideas. some small fragment of them are actually good ones. But I really thought through, and I have a bit of a reputation of like just wanting to build things.
Right.
So we had been kind of thinking on this idea for about three or so months after we had all of our build logic running in this Python framework in the what's now Cumulus CI. And of like, why don't we just build our own CI system that's just a Python web app that sits on top of all of this and runs it and runs out on Heroku? And, you know, I for the longest time, I was like, no, I can't take that to Kevin. I'll get shot down. There's no way that that's going
to
work.
I have to ask, how well documented does an idea that crazy have to be to get sold?
I still have the 2-page Google Doc that I wrote up to bring to Kevin. And it was, you know, I basically went through and laid out, like, here's the different cloud CI systems that are available. And there was one challenge in particular that was really hard to find a cloud CI provider that could handle, which was this challenge of concurrency blocking. So in Jenkins, there's a build concurrency plugin where you can say, like, these two jobs can't run at the same time. And only one instance of this job can run at a time.
Got it.
And if a bunch of builds queued up, those other jobs would just queue and wait until the running job finished, and then they would run.
And then kick off, yeah.
And that basic functionality actually doesn't exist in most cloud hosting providers, because most cloud hosting systems are designed with this idea that your code is built inside of a virtual machine. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case in the Salesforce world.
Right.
And so it seems like a really simple difference, but it threw this huge wrench into our ability to find a cloud hosting provider. Mm-hmm. And the specific challenge is, you know, this was actually, we were starting, Scratchorgs were starting to come out. We had the early dev preview access to Scratchorgs. So we were starting to build on Scratchorgs. So we could run our feature branch builds in parallel now, full concurrency. But we couldn't do that with the packaging org builds. So when we wanted to go upload a package, there's a single packaging org. And you don't want two builds running against it at the same time. Mm-hmm. Really bad things could happen.
Right.
So that was a big part of the pitch. It's still in Cumulus CI about 40 lines of Python code that handles all of that logic. That was the blocker for me to find any cloud hosting system. So my pitch to Kevin was, give me 2 weeks to prototype this.
Yeah.
And this was around Thanksgiving at the end of 2016. And he's like, okay, I'll bet 2 weeks. Let's see where this goes. And I had, at the end of that 2 weeks, a prototype of Cumulus CI running on Heroku with worker dynos spinning up Scratch orgs and calling Cumulus CI flows, which are kind of our named orchestrations in Cumulus CI to run a build. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it didn't have much of a UI around it at that point, but it was working. And I was able to show that to Kevin. Kevin's like, yeah, roll forward with it. And
nice.
So we went into production with what's now Meta CI. And we went into production with that in January of 2017. And have been running all of our projects through it since.
Wow.
I think we've run something like 240,000 builds against it or through that system. almost all of those with Scratch orgs. We burst up to about 100 concurrent builds at a time.
Wow.
You know, each one creating their own Scratch org and running. And, you know, it has been awesome. And because it's running on Heroku just bills you down to the second. So we built auto-scaling into Meta CI now. So it monitors the build queue and then spins up worker dynos for you and then runs the builds. And whenever the queue goes back down to zero, it scales everything back down to zero. And so, you know, it's remarkably efficient at being able to burst up that much. And,
yeah.
And you know, we see those bursts usually towards the end of a sprint when everybody's wanting to merge their stuff in and there's a lot more demand on the builds. But we don't need 100, you know, build dynos sitting around full time wasting resources. Like, we need to be able to burst to that capacity, but that's not our normal load.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the building and developing side of it as well.
Yeah, these are one of my favorite events and things. So I mentioned, you know, the sprints in the Salesforce.org world, I have to catch myself all the time in trying to say, like, oh, we built this amazing community, because really the community built itself. We've just been here to kind of facilitate it and help it along. But starting, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, We hired Judy Sohn, who is amazing. She's currently the director of our customer-centric engineering team. And at the time that we hired her, we have the Power of Us Hub, which is our Salesforce community with, you know, hundreds of thousands of nonprofit and education users in it, and partners mm-hmm. and staff from Salesforce.org, all like self-supporting each other. It's an amazing community. And Judy was like the most prolific poster on the Hub when we hired her. Nice. You know, like I'd wake up in the morning and like all the questions Judy had already answered. You know, she's East Coast, so she had a, you know, a little bit of an advantage on me, but right. still it was remarkable.
Yeah.
And so we hired her as our kind of open source program manager, and she helped, you know, sort of grow the sprint program. And really it formalized a few years ago. We started running these open source sprints a couple of times a year. And the sprints generally, like for the last 2 years, we've run 3 sprints a year in the US and then 1 in EMEA. Mm-hmm. And I haven't attended any of the EMEA ones. I would have loved to. It's like, I think in Amsterdam and in Paris, both places that I've never been before. So, nice. But in the US, we have these 3 sprints a year. They're 2-day sprints, usually somewhere between 100 to 200 attendees, and a good mix between our nonprofit and education customers, our partners in the .org ecosystem, and staff from Salesforce.org. So we get a lot of our, you know, developers that are working on the products there attending the sprints. And it's a very unconference type event. Starts mm-hmm. out with just kind of brainstorming of ideas of what could, you know, what could be built that would help nonprofits, or what are the skills, even in a non-technical sense. Like there's the last couple of sprints, there's been a group focused on admin soft skills and just creating documentation about soft skills for admins.
Nice.
But there's also teams that are, you know, they want to build something really cool and think it would be impactful and want to build it as something open source. So they get together at a round table, spend 2 days hacking away at something. And there's a demo session at the end. And I mean, everybody that I've talked to that comes to one of these sprints, like by the end of it, it's just, you know, this amazing, it's been this amazing experience for them. And we have a lot of regulars that keep coming back to sprint after sprint. One of the challenges, though, is we started to realize about 2 years ago that what was happening when people were building stuff at the sprint is oftentimes somebody would spin up like a scratch they'd spin up a sandbox or they'd spin up a DE org, and everybody would kind of share the login and go in and build something in that org over the 2 days. Mm-hmm. But then that thing that they built would kind of live and die in that org.
Right.
And, you know, the idea of like, how do I get that into my org? How do I sustain this as a project was a real challenge. And, you know, we started to realize like, hey, we've sort of figured this out for our internal projects. We figured out how to run an open source project through GitHub and built all this tooling to do it.
Yeah.
What if we made that tooling available to our community? I mean, the tooling was already open source, but like, how do we enable our community to be able to use this tooling so that these projects can kind of be run through version control, can be sustainable? And last year we started a half day training session before each one of the sprints where I get to do a hands-on training session with like up to 50 people, mostly Salesforce admin level users that, you know, a fair number of them had not really worked in command line before, were, you know, a bit anxious about working in command line, had never used Git or GitHub, and maybe had gone through the Salesforce DX trails, but most likely not. So had never spun up a scratch org or anything like that. And, you know, the way that we looked at it is every single member of our community that we train up to use that process has an exponential multiplier effect for every sprint going forward.
Right.
You know, they could go around and sit at one of those round tables and help make sure that the things, these awesome things that are being built by that team are something that can carry on to the next sprint and you can work on in between sprints. And so, you know, we did that. The first training class was a little bit rough. I didn't really have all the material together all that well, but the last two actually went great.
Yeah.
In Detroit, we had, I think, about 30 people. They got all the way through the process of, you know, creating a new GitHub repository, using Cumulus CI to set up the repository, spin up a scratch org, go make changes in the scratch org in the declarative user interface, use Cumulus CI to retrieve those back into the repository, commit them to a feature branch, submit a pull request, review a pull request, merge it, you know. And I mean, to me, it was just so cool to see this room full of people that had never been exposed to any of that after 3 hours
Right.
Be comfortable with that process. And then in Philadelphia, which was our last sprint last year, there was 50 people that went through that training. And the curriculum for that training actually is the pretty much the first three modules of the Cumulus CI Trailhead Trail that we launched in March.
Got it.
And then the additional three modules beyond that kind of extend upon that idea. So it's the trail is told from the story of a food bank that has built some customizations on top of NPSP to run a food bank. Mm-hmm. And they want to share that with another food bank that's not on Salesforce yet.
Nice.
So how do you go about doing that as a Salesforce admin? Because you know, most admins are trained in change sets, in deployments between these connected orgs, like a sandbox in production or sandbox and other sandbox orgs. But how do you share something that you've built outside of that structure with like a totally different org?
Right.
And so that's the story that we try to walk through in the trail. And we really tried to target that trail towards people that are admin users that maybe don't have a familiarity with the command line. Mm-hmm. We try to keep the commands that you run as simple as possible and approachable. But I think, you know, hopefully it's just another way of getting more people enabled to be able to use this tooling to participate in these open source projects.
Right. During the sprints themselves, have there been any kind of interesting side projects that have come up?
Yeah, there's a ton. the one that amazed me the most at the Philadelphia sprint is Chris Pfeiffer from Attain, one of our partners, who is a sprint regular. He's been at like every sprint for I think the last 2 years.
Nice.
I love going to the in-person sprints and seeing him every day. And Chris had this crazy idea at the last one, which I guess, as I mentioned earlier, I love crazy ideas.
So. Right.
And honestly, myself and one of my team members who was there heard this idea announced at the beginning and we're like, there's no way. You know, kind of whispered to ourselves, like, okay, we're gonna stay away from that project. There's no way this is going to happen. But the idea was to use flows to build Apex tests.
Oh, okay.
You know, and, you know, the idea was that admins should be able to write tests in Salesforce. Uh-huh. And by the end of the sprint, Chris was demoing a working test written in flows that goes and creates objects, checks the values on the objects after a trigger runs in the background and stuff like that. And it's still up there in a public GitHub repository. I just tweeted about it last week. Somebody was asking about, you know, wow, it'd be really cool if admins could write tests in flows. And I was like, hey. No. And, you know, it still has a lot of work to do. It's very much just a prototype of like, you know, is this possible? But
right.
Yeah, I mean, the ingenuity of this community that we have, I think part of what amazes me about the nonprofit tech space in particular, and also the education tech space, is just, I think that you get a different type of innovation when you have people that are motivated for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it's really like a passion project, like it's something that like you recognize this thing that I'm doing is going to make the world a better place. You know, it's not just about like, you know, generating more sales or making somebody more money, which, you know, has huge value. I don't mean to downplay that.
Right.
But the types of innovation that you get when people are just out to, you know, when it's personal to them, you know, it's like the statement about like a, you know, an army that's defending their home territory fights better than an army that's trying to invade somebody else's
sure,
territory.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of that aspect in our community, which is just really cool to see.
Nice. And what has it been like, because we're recording this in an interesting time. So what's it been like taking an open source sprint to being virtual?
Yeah, we our first sprint this year was supposed to be in Atlanta at the beginning of April. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that had to be canceled. It was devastating to us to have to cancel the in-person event because, you know, we have members of our community that are just personally paying to come to
right.
the event.
Yeah.
And so that was a really hard decision, but it was absolutely the right decision for, you know, the health of all of our community and such. Mm-hmm. And we decided that we were going to do an open source sprint or a virtual sprint instead. And I remember having this conversation with Judy Sohn, where she told me we had 100 people register, like 105 people register. She's like, generally turnout on open or on, you know, virtual events is about 30%.
Right.
So I'm anticipating we'll have about 30 people show up.
Yeah.
So the first day of the sprint, I load up the Zoom call and there's 100 people. And it was just awesome.
Yeah.
We used a Quip Doc to kind of set up breakout rooms. And this was all like designed in 2 weeks' time or something like that, this whole structure for doing it. But I think it speaks to our community that everybody was, you know, willing to give it a try, willing to innovate and try to figure out how to make this work. Mm-hmm. And it really did. It was cool. There were a number of projects that got worked on and some really great work that was done. Those individual breakout rooms were kind of like a roundtable at the sprint. Part that I'm sad about not having the in-person events is, you know, one of my favorite parts of the sprints is, you know, our team at Salesforce.org is all remote. Mm-hmm. We're almost all remote. And so I work from home. I don't have regular interactions with like even my team members,
right,
in person, or members of our community in person. So, you know, the ability to just like go hang out at the hotel restaurant or the, yeah, hotel bar and like have a conversation with somebody after the sprint and get to know them better is awesome. And there were definitely some like social calls and stuff like that. People stayed on for like a happy hour after at the end of the sprint, mm-hmm, and chat a little bit. But that part I think is irreplaceable.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, we had attendees from all over the world. We had, mm-hmm, an attendee from India at our sprint that would have never been able to make one of our in-person,
right,
sprints. So I think what we learned from that was, you know, our community is awesome and they'll bear with us and figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
And the right way to probably do sprints and think about sprints going forward is a mix of both.
Yeah.
You know, when we get to a point where we can actually meet in person again.
Right. Okay. So let's move to a different topic. Talk to me about what the Open Source Commons is and what it does.
Yeah. So Open Source Commons is kind of two things. It is the umbrella term for our community.
Gotcha.
And for these community sprints. And it is, you know, one thing to emphasize is Open Source Commons is a very individual oriented thing.
Mm-hmm.
So our partners who are sending their staff to attend the Open Source Commons sprints, mm-hmm, are sending their staff, are facilitating their staff as individuals to participate in the sprint. It's not them as an employee to participate in the sprint. You know, we really want to have that, you know, these are people that are there out of their personal passion, mm-hmm, kind of approach to the community. And the other side of Open Source Commons is sort of came from, you know, going back to the days of like Ant and Jenkins and running all of this stuff on our own.
Right.
And having come from an open source Python background, I remember many years ago, Travis CI, when it came into the ecosystem and started running, you know, it started out as a system to run builds for open source projects. And there were thousands of open source projects that ran on it. And it was awesome because most open source projects can't set up their own Jenkins server and run it and have the infrastructure for that. And it provided just this huge value to the open source community.
Right.
And so I always had this idea of like, wow, we figured out how to do continuous integration for Salesforce projects.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to be the Travis CI for our community, essentially, or something like that, mm-hmm, where we're providing that kind of a service to them. But it was always tricky to figure out from a legal and security, you know, all these other standpoints.
Sticky little things, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, I think about 2.5 years ago, Judy and I managed to convince Kevin that this was a crazy idea that was worthwhile. And he's like, fine, yes, figure out a way that we can do this. And so the Open Source Commons kind of program is, I guess, to some degree, like an incubator for these open source projects in the nonprofit and education ecosystem. So there's a set of qualifying criteria that really focuses on the sustainability of the project.
Gotcha.
Like, these projects are part of the Salesforce.org Open Source Commons, so our name is attached to them, mm-hmm, even though they're community-run projects. But our customers are trusting those projects based on their trust in us. So we want to make sure that somebody's not going to, you know, it's not just that you built something really cool. It's that you've got a team of people that are dedicated to maintaining this project over time. You're not going to leave our customers stranded. And if you did happen, you know, everybody on the project won the lottery at the same time and they moved to a private island, and other people in the community wanted to come forward and maintain that project,
right,
that we could transfer ownership of the packaging org over to those new maintainers.
Gotcha.
And so we had to figure out this whole model for sustainability. And, you know, the advantage of why you would want to go through that process is kind of twofold. One, for visibility. So we have the SFDO community organization on GitHub, where official open source commons projects get hosted. And then also because we run all of our tooling. So MetaCI that I was talking about earlier, also MetaDeploy, which is our web-based installer that's at install.salesforce.org. There's an open source commons tab on there that you can go out and install open source commons applications.
Gotcha.
So we try to basically, if like the challenge in the nonprofit and education ecosystem is not people's desire to share. Nonprofits have an inherent desire to share. Food banks want to share with other food banks in the county next to them. You know, pet rescue organizations want pets to be rescued no matter which organization's doing it. and so there's this inherent desire to share. It's just that people don't know how to.
Right.
And that's the thing that we try to solve with Open Source Commons and through these community sprints is really, we will help you share these things. We will take some of the pain of, like, you know, creating releases of your managed package and stuff like that. If you're not familiar with doing that, now it's just a click of a button through MetaCI and you get your release of your package. And you know, we'll manage deploying it out to MetaDeploy and making it available for people to go out and install for you.
Got it.
And you run the project through GitHub, people submit pull requests, you just review the pull request, merge it, and you get a beta release automatically. So a lot of the, you know, what we built in order to make, you know, my team's life easy to support all our internal development teams, we also want to put that into the hands of these open source projects.
That's our show. Now, when I asked about his favorite non-technical hobby, Jason admitted to being a former DJ and really into music production. And he brought up an interesting factoid that there is an interesting combination of skills when it comes to being a musician and being a programmer.
Because you have to think about things in the abstract, like you're running a composition through your head and then hearing it play. And University of North Texas here in the Dallas area in Denton is one of the top music composition schools in the country. So they were like, hey, go hire music composition majors out of UNT. And it was apparently a wildly successful program.
My thanks to Jason for the great conversation. And of course, my thanks to you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see show notes, and links to your favorite podcast services. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.